This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
Mesdames et messieurs.
Just under a year ago in the Maracanã, Rio's fabled soccer stadium, the Olympic flag was passed to representatives of Tokyo, where the 2020 Summer Games will take place.
So we welcome to the stage now the president of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, along with the mayor of Rio de Janeiro.
It is customary for the president of the IOC to close the games by declaring them the best ever. On August 21st, 2016, Thomas Bach did not disappoint.
These were marvelous Olympic Games in the marvelous city. History will talk about the Rio de Janeiro before and a much better Rio de Janeiro after the Olympic Games.
Even as President Bach was celebrating all his organization had done for Rio, about 15 miles from the Maracanã, a celebration of another sort was underway. The site was Villa Autódromo. It used to be a neighborhood of more than 500 families, and now it's an outpost of 20 small, identical houses. Teresa Williamson was there.
You know, their doors were open in these 20 new homes, and people were out flowing into the street, and people were serving food, things like barbecue and rice and beans and stew and kind of Brazilian fare, and there was music playing.
Williamson, a city planner, is the executive director of Catalytic Communities. For years, her organization has been providing support to residents of Rio's favelas, the neighborhoods built over generations by thousands of the city's workers. Some of the favelas are dilapidated and dangerous. Others are vibrant and welcoming. Villa Autódromo was one of the latter. On that August day over a year ago, when the people in Villa Autódromo had had their fill of rice and beans and music, many of them began marching toward the Olympic Park. They carried with them a message.
It was a look what you've done tone to it, and it was also a we're not going away.
Before the 2016 Games began, while the paint was still drying on some of the Olympic venues, we spoke with people who'd visited Villa Autódromo, located on a lagoon near what became Olympic Park. Well before the Games and the 2014 World Cup, developers had coveted that real estate. The two mega events provided them with the leverage to act. Last August, I spoke with a geographer, Chris Gaffney, about how that leverage was applied.
Where you go in and you give money to one person to leave, you go and destroy their house, you leave the rubble, and then their neighbors have their property devalued because there's rubble that hasn't been cleaned and rats, and you're living in a place that looks like it was hit by a bomb.
Or in this case, a lot of bombs and some wrecking balls. But at night, you couldn't see the broken stone and piles of garbage the city had stopped collecting because the city had also stopped turning on the streetlights. How well did those tactics, the result of a powerful partnership between private developers, the IOC, and the authorities in Brazil, work? A year after the 2016 Games, it's a question we can answer, at least as regards that particular favela. Even before the first bulldozers appeared in Villa Autódromo, the residents fell into several categories. Those who accepted, albeit unhappily, the inadequate offers of compensation for their property, those whose homes were seized by means of eminent domain, and the people most determined to resist those outcomes. Members of the third group gathered at the Residents Association. It had a headquarters, and on February 24th, 2016, a day Teresa Williamson remembers vividly, that headquarters was demolished by developers.
Right when it happened, there was a sense of, it's over. This is over. But then, very quickly, it just felt like it took on a non-territorial nature. All of a sudden, Villa Autódromo wasn't the physical space of the community. It was a movement, or it was an idea, it was a concept, it was something bigger. And actually, by the next day, people in the community had spray-painted Residents Association on homes all over the community. So it was kind of a way of saying, you know what, we don't need that particular physical space.
The destruction of homes and public spaces in Villa Autódromo inspired among those most determined to remain a greater commitment to resistance. One of the more vocal resistors was a woman named Maria de Pena.
She always used to say, not everyone has a price. you know, I didn't put my house up for sale, so my house has no price. I'm not interested in moving. So why is this assumption that everything can be bought and sold?
For 20 families, that rallying cry worked. Though they could not prevent the bulldozers from leveling their homes, they would not agree to leave Villatodromo. For those families, the state ended up building 20 white houses in the empty space where there had been a thriving community.
They almost felt like little suburban U.S. lots on a kind of a cul-de-sac, but they were small.
And they were all the same, until one family put a barber chair in front of their house and offered the other residents haircuts, and until another family added a ramp to their home. Necessity and imagination bred more innovations. That tiny neighborhood, the remains of Villatodromo, was where the counter-closing ceremony's march began. But by the time it happened, the spirit that had animated the favela had been transplanted, as had Eloisa Elena, a practitioner of Candomblé, a religion based on African beliefs and rituals. Elena wasn't at the party in the neighborhood of the 20 homes. Maybe it was too hard for her to come back to the site of Villatodromo because of the home she'd once owned there.
There were several, you know, rooms, a kitchen. There was a garden all around it where she planted special trees. Some of them were medicinal or had religious purposes for the rituals that she would carry out. She had animals, dogs, you know, cats, I believe turtles. And you would go around the back, and there were a couple of rooms that she had allowed people to come and live who were needing homes in the community.
Eloisa Elena's home also had the ingredient most important in real estate: location, location, location. Her house abutted the lagoon, which was central to her rituals.
People would come from other parts of Rio to get support from her. That home was incredibly sacred to her. It was a lot more than a physical dwelling.
The home was an impediment to the IOC and the developers who wanted to gentrify the area, so they pressured Eloisa Elena to leave. She says the pressure included death threats.
So I saw her when she was really feeling at her worst. She was, you know, shaking and clearly disturbed by what she was experiencing from the city, and we wanted to do whatever we could to expose that. So she's been pushed essentially to the urban fringes. That's what she was able to afford to buy with the compensation that would meet her needs.
Specifically, Elena has been pushed 60 to 90 minutes from the life she had built for herself, the life with which she had comforted others. Elena began writing about what had happened to her for a website managed by Teresa Williamson. It helped to tell her story, and that story felt familiar to many of those who read it. Like Elena, they were living far from family, friends, and work. Some of the former residents were placed in public housing not far from Villatodromo. It was substandard, and unlike their previous neighborhood, it was not of their making. They and their parents and their grandparents hadn't built it. But their displacement and the displacement of roughly 70,000 additional Brazilians is only part of what the Olympics wrought. Geographer Chris Gaffney, with whom we recently reconnected, has been studying the impact of mega events on host cities, including Rio, for more than 10 years.
I was in Rio for the Olympics. I spent 10 weeks there before the Games and during the Games and then a little bit of follow-up.
Is the situation better or worse than you anticipated it would be?
Oh, that's a really hard question for me to answer because I was pretty negative before, and it's worse than I thought.
Gaffney says that the Games exceeded projected costs by more than $1.5 billion, and it's not the IOC that picks up the tab. It's the people of Brazil. That sad truth was reinforced after the Games when Carlos Nuzman, the head of Rio 2016, traveled to Switzerland to ask the IOC for around $40 million to help cover the shortfall. The answer was no. But what about the improvements the Games were supposed to bring to Rio?
What we saw in terms of legacy, quote-unquote, benefits were that the bay was not cleaned up. There was very little improvement to the water quality in the city. There was no improvement to the sewage capacity of the city. And we saw vast areas of public land being open for real estate speculation instead of solving the problems of homelessness and gentrification that the city was experiencing.
There were some improvements to parts of the public transportation system, but most of them were of minimal benefit to the poorest citizens of Rio. And because hosting the Games further burdened Brazil's sinking economy, even some of what was in good shape before the Olympics has deteriorated. Daily tours to the Maracanã, where those closing ceremonies took place, have been suspended. The facility is in what CNN described as a state of decay. The stadium's power was cut off months ago. Nobody had paid the electric bill. But out of the displacement and despair, a new energy has been born. Eloisa Helena has moved beyond writing about her personal loss. She has spoken before the Human Rights Commission of the Brazilian Senate. As Teresa Williamson has put it, Helena has found her voice, and she's not the only one.
Yeah, the people who stayed in Vila Autódromo, they were the ones that resisted the hardest. They were the ones who didn't negotiate with the city at any point in the long 5-6 year battle. And so they've really taken on this personality, this characteristic of being a resistance zone.
They've even established the open-air eviction museum, which features such artifacts as the barricade the residents built to prevent traffic through the neighborhood during the games. These days, the remaining residents of Vila Autódromo welcome tourists and tell them stories of resistance. They've inspired their fellow citizens in other favelas to embrace their rights and fight for the land they've made their own.
It's amazing how the community has kept itself very much on mission, even a year almost after the Olympics, just keeping the memory alive of the community, of its resistance, and also the message of hope.
Perhaps that's the ultimate legacy of the Rio Olympics. A vulnerable people fed lies about the improvements the Games would bring and then forced from their homes has figured out how to regard themselves not as victims, but as champions. When experts predicted that baseball's Ichiro Suzuki would get his 3,000th hit in 2015, Ben Wells knew enough to know better.
I was just like, that's not going to happen this year. He hasn't had over 140 hits in a few seasons. He's probably going to have that happen in 2016.
How Ben's math led to a most excellent adventure coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank iTunes user 02847281629 for leaving a review of Only a Game. An hour I look forward to, 02847281629 says, it's amazing every time how much the best and worst of humanity is reflected in an athlete's perseverance and the stories you bring to our ears. Sublime justice and beauty that stops me cold to reflect on greater things. Thank you, 02847281629 for that review. Consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It really is the best way to help other listeners find our show and make me read silly usernames every week. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's nearing the end of July, which means it must be time to start thinking about the upcoming NFL season. That's ridiculous. Who wrote that? Anyway, that's where we're going to begin this week's three stories you should know. Joining me are Sports on Earth's Will Leach via Skype and Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you. It's great to be back. An honor as always.
And Michael, I can't help myself. I have to say it. You're ready for some football?
Sort of.
That's my kind of answer.
I would like to see someone actually playing football who doesn't have a job right now, and that's Colin Kaepernick, you know, who burst on the scene nearly 5 years ago as the heavily tattooed, bicep-smooching lightning bolt who led the 49ers to the Super Bowl, but became a lightning rod last season for his national anthem protests. His absence has been head-scratching and upsetting to many, but it delved into another realm this week when former NFL quarterback Mike Vick decided that Kaepernick needed to cut his hair for teams to take him seriously and give him a second chance. Vic later apologized. The conversation won't end anytime soon, but this aspect should. Kaepernick won't get a job simply because he cuts his hair. But my question to you is, what will it take for some team to finally sign the best unemployed quarterback out there?
this whole situation has just shown me something about America that I did not think was true or did not want to believe was true and is very clearly true. And I found myself very disappointed with a lot of my fellow media on this, to be honest. It's been very surprising me to see people who you would think would be reasonable-minded people saying, well, listen, Kaepernick, we think he's a good enough quarterback to play too, but if he were really dedicated to playing, he would not be so loud and active about this stuff. Clearly, it shows that his activism is more important than football, which the idea that that is a binary choice, it really kind of shows you how much you are supposed to give up everything for the NFL, a league that would cut you in a half a second and not pay you and not think one iota about it. Every player is supposed to give up every aspect, positive, negative, political or non-political, of their personality just for the honor of being a part of this league. It's just another reason why the NFL is just so infuriating.
If Colin Kaepernick had kept his hair short, he would have a job today. I'm almost positive that that's the first thing that a sharp scout looks at is hair length. And you can tell a lot by a guy's hair length. You can tell whether he's recently had his hair cut short. Think about what a great quarterback Ken Stabler might have been if he shaved more often and gotten a haircut every once in a while. He might have been terrific. I'm sorry. Absurd is the only way to go with this. This is so disgusting and so discouraging.
I think that everyone needs to stop trying to rationalize this and just come to grips and understand that this man has been blackballed by the league, and people just need to be honest about it and also confront exactly the reasons why he is in that situation. I think that for the whole time that this protest is taking place, people have found other things outside, ancillary factors to debate, but they're not confronting the main issue. And I think just as no one wanted to confront what Colin Kaepernick was fighting, no one wants to confront what's happening to him right now on a real level. And I think that that's the only way we're going to make progress, is if people confront the truth and not try to dance around it with other things that are just distractions.
At a conference this week, the commissioners of this country's four major sports discussed, among other things, the future of sports gambling. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver is in favor of allowing more gambling. He says it will increase, quote, fan engagement. MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred agrees with that, but he offered a curious quote. He said, "It seems to me that there's a difference between somebody betting on whether the next pitch is going to be a ball or a strike, which is very hard for anybody to affect or control, as opposed to betting on the outcome of a game, which is a little different. Suppose I could find a vulnerable umpire. I go to him. I say, okay, look, the first pitch to each batter in each of the first three innings is a ball, or else your life takes a bad turn. Obviously, I don't care who wins the game. By the top of the fourth, I'm in a limo. I'm on my way to the airport." Is Rob Manfred as full of beans and bananas as I think he is, Will?
In this particular scenario, it's hard to argue he isn't, though. My dirty secret in this is that I actually think gambling on sports is wrong and bad for sports in general. I know that makes me like a rube or something.
Makes you rich.
I know, yeah. No, it makes me a sucker is what it makes me. Remember, baseball had this issue with gambling because they had this horribly tragic event happen where you didn't know who had won the World Series, and it scarred the game for so long. Now, the NBA roughly had an equivalent of this when you saw with the referee scandal a few years, and it took like a couple years until all of a sudden everyone realized, wait, we can make so much money off DraftKings and all of these things. How quickly we have gone from when you see what gambling has done to our sports, it must be taken as far away as possible. To, well, maybe just betting on a small event isn't that big of a deal. And from the commissioner of the sport is actually pretty wild.
You know, I agree with Will. I'm probably a bit of a prude too. I just don't think that gambling should be in sports. Haven't we kicked out Pete Rose for life for gambling on the game? I mean, you make an example of the all-time greatest hitter. You keep him out of your Hall of Fame because he gambled, and then all of a sudden you open up the sport for people to bet on it.
Will, take us to the sweet science that has of late been less than sweet.
Yeah, and an entirely unrelated topic to gambling destroying a sport. Let's talk boxing. I do not remember a time where I have felt more desire to run in the opposite direction of sports than watching the international press tour, as they called it last week, for the McGregor-Mayweather fight, which is coming up in August. I swear I could actually feel chunks of my soul falling off while watching it. the epithets they've been calling each other have been misogynist. They've been racist in this kind of like cross promotion. Boxing, it's UFC. What's stronger? And this is what boxing has come to. It's the only way to sell kind of what's left of this sport. And the sad part about it is I'm a little worried it's going to work.
Yeah. But Michael, you're going to be signed up for the pay-per-view, right?
Absolutely not. For a lot of reasons, I'm not a big Floyd Mayweather fan, and I can't think of a fight that has done more to encourage me to see two guys just beat each other to a bloody pulp. I don't want either one of them to win because, going in, I think it was interesting to see this fight come together because there was so much anticipation. But I think that the way they've behaved and the way they promoted this fight, it's not encouraging. It's not uplifting in any way. I mean, the power of sport is that you generally try to inspire. And I'm trying to figure out what they're trying to inspire us to do other than dislike each other. And that's not a good thing.
The other thing is, doesn't this sort of test the gullibility of the public? Because, Will, you talked about boxing versus the UFC, what's stronger, but that's not what it is. A boxer is going to box against a guy who's never boxed before in his life.
Right.
That seems to me the most stupid event I can imagine since that silly exercise where Muhammad Ali went into the ring with that Japanese guy who kicked his legs out from under him a bunch of times and there was no boxing involved at all.
This is not like, it's not even like a promotion where it's like Michael Phelps tries to race a dolphin or something. It's more like
Shark.
Aaron.
Yeah,
it's
I'd
like
pay
Aaron,
to see that.
Yeah,
I do
this is
see
like
that.
Aaron Judge tries to race a dolphin. Like it's something that doesn't even relate to his sport. It's not so much gullibility, but it's funny, Michael, you talked about the idea of like, you know what? I'd like to see these two beat the crap out of each other. I think that's exactly what they're counting on. It's just going to be ugly. It's just going to be terrible. And people are going to pay $95 for the privilege.
Ugh. All right. I'm sorry, guys. I'm going to have to cut this short because I have to go see if I can get a bet down on Michael Phelps v. that dolphin.
Well, he's got the shark race coming up, so.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been Sports on Earth's Will Leach and Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
When an athlete reaches a major milestone, that accomplishment has been built on years, sometimes decades, of hard work and determination. But our next story is about a fan, and this fan had quite a bit invested in a milestone as well. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Scroll through the Twitter feed of a 33-year-old guy named Ben Wells, past the photos of the Chicago Cubs-themed sneakers that he and his date wore to a wedding reception in June, and you'll eventually come to a string of videos, all posted around this time last year. Most of the videos are short, and they end abruptly. These videos document a period of extreme fan frustration, but Ben says,
I would absolutely do it again.
It all started on Major League Baseball's opening day 2015, which also happened to be Easter Sunday.
The Cubs were playing the Cardinals and had just gotten home from having the family dinner. My dad and a few friends actually came over to my house and we were watching the game. And ESPN's Sunday night coverage was doing like upcoming milestones and one of the things that they had highlighted was Ichiro being 156 hits away from 3,000.
Ben knew enough to know better.
I was just like, that's not going to happen this year. He hasn't had over 140 hits in a few seasons, and now he's not even an everyday player with the Marlins and their young, impressive outfield. So he's probably going to have that happen in 2016.
Ben had already been to spring training, opening day, and an all-star game. He'd seen his Cubbies in the playoffs, but he'd never seen a major milestone like this. So right then and there, with his family and friends as witnesses, Ben Wells announced his plan. In the summer of 2016, he'd do whatever it took to see Ichiro's 3,000th hit. He started planning right away.
So I actually found a second job.
Ben delivered pizzas at night after working all day at a car dealership, and then
I actually ended up finding a third job and started working on the weekends at a local apple orchard.
Ben drove the apple train filled with kids around the orchard for 8 hours a day every weekend. He rarely saw his friends. When he wasn't working,
they understood that, nah, Ben's going to be tired. He's just not going to do anything. So we'll see him in October.
As opening day 2016 approached, Ichiro needed just 65 hits. Based on how long it took him to reach 65 hits in the previous season, Ben figured the 3,000th hit would come in July.
Just doing all the nerd calculations, and was like, all right, it's going to be the 24th.
And as it turned out, Miami was starting a 10-game homestand on July 22nd.
Cool, 10 games. Homestand will be perfect. It'll happen.
But Ben knew better than to trust the bat of a 42-year-old pinch hitter. Luckily, after their 10-game homestand, Miami would be playing 3 games in Chicago, not too far from Ben's home in DeKalb. Ben waited until the last minute to book his flight, but his math had actually worked. Ichiro was 4 hits away when Ben boarded the plane for Miami.
Having the 13 games in place, I was pretty confident that it was going to happen and that I was going to be able to see it. But I show up to the airport and end up with an 8-hour flight delay. And so then I'm stuck at the airport and was just like, well, this is what's going to happen. They're going to end up starting him. I'm going to miss that game. I'm going to just be sitting here at the airport and watching it on a TV.
Don't worry. That's not what happened. Ben's flight left O'Hare at 6 the next morning, and he arrived at his great-aunt's house in Miami with plenty of time to get to the ballpark. Ben Wells had 13 days to see history. But on day one, Ichiro didn't even start. The Marlins were in the hunt for a playoff spot, and manager Don Mattingly had no intention of changing his game plan just so Ichiro could reach that milestone.
He only got one at bat, and it was a pinch hit later in the game, and he actually struck out, so he was 0 for 1 that night.
For the first 3 days of Ben's trip, the Marlins only used Ichiro as a pinch hitter. And in those 3 days, he didn't get a hit.
Now everybody's starting, even my friends are starting to text me and even comment on my Facebook posts of like, what's going on? Is he going to start? Are you going to be able to see this? Like, when's it going to happen? And I'm just like, it's going to happen. It'll be okay.
Ben says he was still having a good time, exploring the ballpark and meeting people from all over the country who'd come to see Ichiro's milestone. So when did you finally get to see a hit?
The first hit finally happened on the 26th. So they finally put him in the lineup. He was 1 for 5.
Maybe the pressure was starting to get to Ichiro. It was definitely getting to Ben.
That's when I kind of started getting a little nervous about how long is this going to be? Is it going to happen in these 13 games that I have scheduled?
The Marlins didn't even use Ichiro on the 5th day of the trip. But the next day, July 27th...
Now he's 2 hits away, and I think it was even before the game was over that the Marlins had tweeted out that he was going to be in the lineup tomorrow.
So you must have been really confident then, right?
Yes.
But Ichiro went 0 for 4 in that game. He didn't get a hit in the next game either. Ben and the Marlins were now headed to Chicago for a 3-game series against the Cubs.
So now that it's been 10 games and only 2 hits, now the thought is, okay, do I need to go to Denver?
Ben wanted to be optimistic. Ichiro should still get this done in Chicago. But Ben contacted some friends in Denver to see if he could stay with them just in case.
They're just like, yeah, no, absolutely. Hope to see you. I was like, well, no offense, but I don't.
And to make super extra sure he'd be able to follow the team to Denver, Ben went back to work at the car dealership so that he wouldn't waste any vacation days. Good thing, too, because during the 3 games in Chicago, Ichiro didn't get a single hit. The team had a day off on Thursday, but it wasn't a day off for Ben.
I was at work and everybody's just like, so you're going to Denver? I was like, yeah, I got the bag packed. I'm going to be leaving after work.
Ben drove through the night, 13 hours. He says he pulled over and took a couple power naps along the way. In the first game in Denver, you guessed it, Ichiro wasn't in the starting lineup. He got one at bat and struck out again. But the next day, the 15th game of Ben's trip, Ben was so excited about hit 2,999 that he stopped recording before the crowd even had time to react. The Marlins kept Ichiro in the game, but he didn't get his 3,000th hit that day. And there was just one more game in Denver before the Marlins would leave for another homestand in Miami.
If it came to it, it was going to be leave the car in Denver, fly down to Miami, hopefully see the 3,000th hit, fly back to Denver, and then drive 13 hours to get home.
But luckily it didn't come to that.
Yes, luckily it did not come to that.
Ichiro Suzuki's 3,000th hit came in the seventh inning on August 7th. And it's this video, not one of his beloved Cubs finally winning the World Series 3 months later, that Ben Wells has pinned to the top of his Twitter feed.
For me, it almost felt like an accomplishment at the time, too. As silly as it sounds, it did, because this was the 16th game in 17 days.
So, bucket list item accomplished. No need to ever go through all that again, right?
As the thought comes up, Adrian Beltre is actually close to 3,000 as well. Looking at it, it's possible that he'll be as close as Minnesota. And so, if that's the case and it falls on a weekend, I think I might try to see 2 3,000s in consecutive years.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Once upon a time, there was a podcast. A podcast that told stories, especially for kids. This podcast gathered folktales from around the world and found amazing actors to bring them to life, including some you might recognize from movies and TV.
Dear wise old woman, you are a genius!
Yep, that's Jason Alexander from Seinfeld.
You won't believe this.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and this podcast we're talking about, it's a real thing. It's called Circle Round. And whether you're a kid, a grown-up, or young at heart, we're coming your way this fall from the WBUR iLab. Hear the first episode now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And come circle round on our website, wbur.org/circleround.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, a love story set on a Cape Cod miniature golf course. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Since we last spoke, Roger Federer won his record 8th Wimbledon men's singles title. Throughout the tournament, he didn't lose a single set. Did he have an easy draw, or is this guy pretty good?
This guy is pretty good. This was a magnificent, magnificent performance. Somewhere on the internet, you can find a mashup of his 20 best shots. All of them are inhuman. I'm sure there are 20 more you could put up there. I mean, this is his 8th title, which means he's won it more than anybody else. And I don't know where you put him on the list except at the top.
Former MLB commissioner and before that Milwaukee Brewers owner Bud Selig will be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Collusion. I'm sorry, the Baseball Hall of Fame next weekend. Based on how much attention he's still paying to the team that he used to own, maybe he should go in as a fan.
I feel bad for Mark Arnazio, who currently owns the Brewers, because apparently Selig is an impossible nudge.
He calls him a couple of times a day. Yeah, how come you traded that guy?
Yeah, well, that's apparently, according to Arnazio, is the problem. It's all this guy and that guy. Selig doesn't have any idea who he means. How come the Cubs let that guy go?
The Houston Astros are so far ahead of the rest of the teams in the American League West that they've had to figure out ways to avoid boredom and amuse themselves, Charlie. And I understand Carlos Beltran came up with a pretty good one this week.
This is really good. I mean, this gets Carlos Beltran a lot of points. He conducted, along with his teammates, a ceremonial burial of his gloves, since he really doesn't play in the field anymore. They wore black shirts, and apparently the catcher, Brian McCann, was the guy who officiated. So
little
good
tombstone
for them.
There
are a little tombstone in center field, yeah.
The NHL free agency period is ongoing, and 45-year-old Jaromir Jagr is still without a team. 16 goals and 30 assists last season for the Florida Panthers. He could still help somebody.
Hire the guy. What is holding these people back? I mean, there are teams that could use 16. You know, he's a perfectly adequate second or third line player at this point.
This week, Julian Edelman, who plays for the New England Patriots, received an apology from his college English teacher. What, the professor realized he'd given Edelman a B- instead of a B on his final paper?
No, he made the mistake of scoffing at Edelman's plans to go to the NFL. And good for him for sending a letter and saying, this is the way it goes. And Edelman tweeted it out, and apparently they're pals again.
The British Open is being contested this
no,
weekend.
Bill, please, the Open Championship. We do not call it the British Open anymore because we are all imperial snobs. Go on. Continue.
Oh. Well, speak for yourself. In any case, there's a tournament over there in the UK.
Yeah.
It's happening this weekend. Mark O'Meara was the winner of the 1998 Open. He had the honor of kicking off the tournament with the first tee shot and...
He hit it to Wales, I think, actually.
Or in that direction, anyway.
Yeah, he hit it way, way out of bounds. And as he said, his day was toast and most people hadn't had their breakfast yet.
You know what they call what his score was on that first hole?
What did he score?
Tour? An 8.
A snowman.
A snowman.
Yes.
Exactly. I didn't know that till fairly recently.
Oh, I knew that years ago.
That's good, because you probably got a lot of 8s.
I know the snowman very well.
We learned this week that O.J. Simpson...
No, do we have to?
No, we don't. I don't. Let's go right by it. The U.S. men's soccer team has come in for some criticism during the Gold Cup tournament, even though they've won as often as they've had to in order to advance. Perhaps the men on the U.S. team should get credit just for enduring, Charlie. In Wednesday night's game against El Salvador, they were victims of at least one bite, maybe two, and a nipple tweak. Wait, what?
Well, is that like code for something FIFA does to accept a bribe?
No,
because like, I assume that that's...
This is literal, and if you watch the video, you will be astonished.
Why would you bite a dude?
Well, why would you tweak his nipple?
Well, and the answer you could be attracted to him.
No, the answer was in order to try to provoke him to shove you down on the ground and hence get a red card, and it didn't work because
it's
the ref
kind
was,
of a lame way to provoke somebody. You just shove him,
yeah,
you know, well, or, it, you know, bite him.
It was very silly. Finally, Charlie,
oh,
the customary way to measure the popularity of a politician is, of course, a poll. But that doesn't mean there isn't room for less scientific ways to gauge the popularity of, say, a sitting governor who catches a foul pop-up at a baseball game and then gives the ball to a little kid. So how did New Jersey's Chris Christie do on that metric the other night?
He got booed to within an inch of his life.
He gave the ball to a kid.
You want to see a living demonstration of what an 81% disapproval rating looks like? Giving the ball to a kid and getting booed is probably it.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week as well here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Charlie Sifford was the first African-American on the PGA Tour. Althea Gibson was the first black LPGA golfer. But there's somebody else you might not have heard of who had a major impact as a trailblazing black golfer. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
My dad used golfing as a life lesson that you have to earn your way, that life is hard, that you have to work at it.
Michael Holmes says that his father, Alfred Holmes, nicknamed Tup, saw golf as more than golf. Michael and his brothers caddied for their dad as soon as they were strong enough to lift a golf bag.
It was tough because my dad was a tough guy. He had these rules. You had to carry the bags. You weren't allowed to ride in the cart. You had to put rubber bands on your pants so that your pants would not flop in the wind and that you don't speak.
As a black golfer in the 30s and 40s, Tup had to contend with rules that were tougher than the ones he imposed on his kids. He learned that excellence on the fairway was no guarantee that he could play where he wanted to in his native Atlanta.
He played at the Lincoln Country Club.
That's Tup's grandson, Hamilton Holmes Jr.
But that was only a 9-hole golf course, and it wasn't the greatest golf course from what I understand either.
That was Tup's understanding, too. None of Lincoln's 9 holes were longer than 300 yards. The greens were small, and the course was poorly maintained. Tup wanted to play elsewhere. But there was a problem.
Back then, the city ordinance here in Atlanta stated that black golfers, or just black people in general, I should say, were not allowed to use public facilities, primarily parks or recreational type areas.
Tup Holmes would take aim at that ordinance, and it would be the fight of his life. Tup Holmes was born in 1917. He learned basic golf skills from area caddies and from his father, Hamilton Mayo Holmes, one of Atlanta's first African-American doctors. Tupp earned a spot on Tuskegee Institute's varsity golf team and won three consecutive Negro intercollegiate championships from 1937 to 1939. He qualified to play in the 1939 NCAA golf tournament, but was turned away because of the color of his skin. He graduated and moved to Detroit, where he sometimes golfed with boxing great Joe Louis. His son, Michael, says Tupp thrived as an amateur.
And he subsequently became the state of Michigan amateur champion and also the state of Ohio amateur champion.
And he won several amateur Negro championships, as they called it back then.
That's Tupp's grandson, Hamilton. Tupp returned to Georgia with his young family in 1948. Michael Holmes marvels at how he did it all.
He had many irons and many fires all at the same time. He owned service stations. He owned an insurance agency. He owned some restaurants, a couple of funeral homes. He was a guy that was always thinking forward.
And Tupp still wanted to play golf. In the early 1950s, only three of Atlanta's more than 130 public parks, which included five golf courses, were accessible to all. By 1951, Tupp had had enough.
He felt that black citizens should have a chance to play on public courses. Their public tax dollars were being used to help support the public courses. So why shouldn't they have a chance to play on the same courses just like everyone else?
So on July 19th, 1951, more than 4 years before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a Montgomery, Alabama bus, Tupp Holmes committed an act of civil disobedience on an Atlanta golf course. Rounding out the foursome were Tupp's father, his brother Reverend Oliver Wendell Holmes, and family friend Charles Bell. Tupp chose the course named for golfing legend Bobby Jones.
They were turned away by the local pro there. They didn't cause a problem. They just turned around and left at that point. But they were determined to try to play on the public courses.
Bobby Jones was a wealthy white Atlantan, famous for regarding golf as the gentleman's game. It wasn't very gentlemanly to bar black golfers from playing on that course. It would have been funny if not for the sheer unfairness of it. And the danger. Back at home, 5-year-old Michael Holmes and his brothers knew something was up.
We began to get very disturbing telephone calls and threats that they would kill us if they found us out on the golf courses if we did not give up on the effort to utilize the golf courses and the parks. A general sense that, hey, get in your place.
Tupp's response to the threats was to organize what he called the Atlanta Golf Committee. He hired attorneys. Letters were sent to the city threatening a lawsuit if African Americans continued to be denied access to municipal courses.
William Hartsfield was the mayor, and the city just didn't respond. The city did not consider the request.
That's Atlanta City Council President Caesar Mitchell. He's currently campaigning for mayor of Atlanta.
It's just a little ironic that Mayor Hartsfield and city government would deny something so basic.
The irony Mitchell refers to, perhaps, is that Hartsfield is remembered by some for fostering Atlanta's image as the city too busy to hate and for winning an election over staunch segregationist Lester Maddox. Again, Hamilton Holmes.
Mayor Hartsfield even tried to initiate having the public courses sold to private individuals so that they could be turned into private courses.
Hartsfield also appropriated $75,000 to build a public course for black golfers. The city shot down that plan, arguing that, quote, Negroes did not play enough to warrant building a separate golf course. After 2 years of frustration, Tupp Holmes, along with his brother and father, filed a petition in U.S. District Court requesting an injunction preventing Atlanta from discrimination at its public courses.
It was filed in 1953, and then in 54, the court said that the city of Atlanta would be able to keep separate but equal courses or be able to have certain days where African Americans could go and play golf on the public courses.
But opposition to the idea that separate could be equal was growing everywhere, including Atlanta. the NAACP offered its resources, and future Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall joined the Holmes legal team as lead attorney. But a series of appeals failed to provide the remedies Holmes was looking for.
So they decided to continue to pursue the court case, and it eventually went to the Supreme Court of the United States.
On November 7, 1955, the Supreme Court sent the case back to district court with strongly worded instructions to end segregation. Again, Caesar Mitchell.
It was not only great for Atlantans, it was great for Georgians, because I think it really made the point that separate but equal was not sufficient and was not the future.
On December 24, 1955, Tup Holmes exercised his hard-won right carefully.
My dad wanted to make sure that my mom and my granddad were protected. There was this kind of underlying notion that they were going to meet violence. And so to avoid a violent conflict, my dad, uncle, and Charles Bell decided to go to North Fulton to avoid the possibility that there would be people waiting on them at Bobby Jones to inflict harm.
And I think that they were smart to do that. And right after that, some other African-American golfers came out on Christmas Day and then days after and continued to play golf on the city courses.
According to Michael, the Holmes versus Atlanta Supreme Court case not only opened up hundreds of Atlanta parks, it served as precedent in dozens of other desegregation cases. Some consider it to be as important as the landmark Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court case of 1954. Tup Holmes died of cancer in 1967. He was only 50 years old. Tup's accomplishments on the course and in the courts went largely unnoticed for years. But on August 20th, 1983, Atlanta Mayor Andrew Young rededicated Adams Park Golf Course and renamed it the Alfred Tup Holmes Memorial Golf Course. His son Michael was there.
All of my brothers and sisters and my mother were alive at that point in time, and we were at the golf course on that day that it was dedicated. I cried, you know, because someone had finally recognized the impact that my family had had on the city of Atlanta and on generations of African Americans.
Hamilton Holmes Jr. and Atlanta City Council President Caesar Mitchell play the Tup Holmes course from time to time. Michael Holmes doesn't golf, but he still visits. All agree that the upkeep there needs improvement. But they also agree that a challenging public golf course welcoming everybody is a fitting tribute to Tup Holmes and a reminder to younger generations. On November 7th, 2015, the 60th anniversary of the Supreme Court's reversal, a dedication ceremony was held at the Bobby Jones Golf Course for an exhibit honoring Tup Holmes. In attendance was the great-granddaughter of Charles Bell, one of the golfers who tried to play there in 1951, but was turned away.
And she asked, who was that man that they were talking about? And why were they talking about that man? She was maybe 3-4 years old. And her dad said something that stuck with me. He said that he was talking about you.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach talking with Michael Holmes. The exhibit honoring Tup Holmes can be viewed until November at Bobby Jones Golf Course in Atlanta. The Holmes family is looking for a permanent location. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. We'd also like to thank Eric Omena de Mello for his help on this week's story about Villa Autódromo. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, our intern is Philip Goldberg, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Hamilton Holmes Jr., grandson of the man who integrated Atlanta's public golf courses and son of one of two students who fought to desegregate the University of Georgia in 1961. And one.
People ask me sometimes, you know, what am I going to do to, you know, to be the first to do something? So, you know, we kind of get a laugh out of that.
Patience, Mr. Holmes. The work's not finished. Something will turn up. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week for more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.